Accession number 28351, Reel 5.
Lord Peter Blaker, Reel 5. If I could ask you now, if you could cast your mind back to when you were wounded, you know, obviously some of the time you must have been unconscious, but could you describe the stages of medical care you had until you arrived in hospital in Britain?
Well, when I was wounded, it felt like being kicked by a horse. Not that I've ever been kicked by a horse, but what I imagine it would be like to be kicked by a horse. But with no pain. Quite extraordinary. I had a hole in my right hip, a foot long and 3 inches wide. And that, of course, has led to trouble since, because it removed so much muscle on that side of me that I've been unbalanced ever since, and had to do exercise and that sort of thing so as to remain mobile. But I was very lucky because it didn't mean losing a limb, it kept me out of the rest of the war. If I'd been lightly wounded, I would have gone back in and run the same risks that I'd already survived. And I don't remember any pain from the wound. The worst pain I had when in hospital was when the doctors took the sticky bandage off me, a very big elastoplast bandage, which was around my body, holding the two sides of the wound together. And when they ripped that off, of course, it pulled a lot of hair. That was really painful, but it was all over very quickly. I think the doctors did a very good job. It was this very large wound, as I say, and they tried once. They sewed the two sides of this wound together, tight, with deep stitches. And the first time they did it, it didn't work. They had to do it again. Second time it worked fine. I think they did a very good job. So I was taken on a ground sheet from the battlefield and put onto a Bren gun carrier, which happened to be there, and taken to the regimental aid post, and then to a field hospital, where there were quite a lot of casualties. We were having just made this new advance, and we had in the company of which I was second in command, we had 30 casualties that day, including the death of the company commander and two of the officers, including myself. And that was not unusual. It was a very punishing affair, although we kept moving forward and were successful. Anyway, I was taken to hospital then from the field hospital where they did a preliminary job. I was taken to a hospital in Antwerp, which had been a convent. And I was in a bed in a ward there. And next to me was a figure entirely swathed in bandages from head to toe. And this was a German motorcyclist who had been saved by us and had been treated and apparently needed all these bandages. I don't know what the reason was, but it was a very strange thing to see. And then after just a few days in Antwerp, I was flown back in a Dakota aircraft carrying a very large number of casualties to Britain in a most uncomfortable way, because there were about three or four layers of stretchers, one above the other, very tightly packed for obvious reasons, so that one couldn't move and one couldn't lift one's head or anything like that, rather claustrophobic. And then I was sent to a Canadian hospital near Bracknell in Berkshire, where I was very well treated, and that's where I was for several months. Have I told you about the problem of the occupational therapist? Well, I'll tell you about that. I remember it very well. Very beautiful English girl, I suppose 19 or 20, who used to come and see me every day and say to me, she'd come to help my morale, which she did, actually, but not by making me do anything, just by looking at her. And she said, wouldn't I like to make a pair of gloves? So I said, no thanks, I'm very happy as I am. So would I like to make a tapestry? And I said, no thanks. And after being besieged by her for quite a long time, I eventually surrendered and said, I would make a tapestry. So she said, what would you like to do? What sort of picture do you want on the tapestry? I said, what about the regimental coat of arms? So she brought some canvas with the regimental coat of arms, stencils onto it, and the necessary wool and needles and so on, gave me rudimentary instruction in how to do it, and then left me alone. And I expected to go on seeing her every day, as I had been. I didn't ever see her again. That was a very serious lesson about the what may happen in life, the disappointments that may happen.
The offer of tapestry.
Yes, that's right. Anyway, the problem about the tapestry was that I hadn't been properly taught, I hadn't been carefully enough taught. The tapestry had a grid on it, and you put your needle through a hole in the grid, pull it out the next hole, and so on. But the regimental coat of arms included the face of a wildcat, face on. And wildcats, like other cats, have whiskers which curve. And what I didn't know was how to produce a picture of these whiskers on the tapestry, because it was on a grid, and the hole in the grid was fairly large. I mean, not just 1 millimeter, but a bit more. So the options appeared to me to be to have the whiskers absolutely parallel. You couldn't have them gently curving. You could have had them zigzagging, but you could have them straight. So I thought, well, one option is to have them straight, horizontal, parallel, like a sergeant major, sergeant major's moustache. Or you could go have them going straight up like that, which would have looked rather odd, going up to directly above. Or you could have had them going down, like a rather sad Chinese mandarin. So I eventually settled for the horizontal whiskers. I still have that tapestry now, which I have beside my bed. But it is a very military-looking wildcat, which I suppose is perhaps appropriate. At any rate, I got out of that regular hospital after 6 months. I became mobile towards the end of that. I had a pair of crutches when I first got out of bed. I remember going out for my first outing in 6 months to the local pub with my crutches, naturally. And we went upstairs in the pub to a room up there with my colleagues from the regiment, or from the hospital, rather. Only some of them were from the regiment. And then after a bit we left, having had a drink or two. And I had no instruction in crutch management. And the first thing I did as we got to the top of the stairs was to put my crutches down 2 steps. And then I realized that if I wasn't careful, I was going to take off. If I then launched myself into space, I would land at the bottom of the stairs without touching any intervening step. So just in time, I managed to avoid that thing. So having then convalesced at this hospital, I was sent to a recuperation unit, I think it was called, something like that, at Colchester. That's where I was on VE Day. And I'd only just arrived there, so I didn't know people. And when the end of the war was announced, I didn't go wild or drink a lot of beer or whatever. I really sat and thought, because I thought, this is so wonderful. No more war in Europe. So that was that's what I did at the time of VJ Day in August 45. That, of course, was very relevant for me because my father had been a prisoner of war with the Japanese. And I did the same sort of thing at that time, except I had rather different thoughts. Even greater relief, because I thought he would be released, which he was, from the Japanese camp. And I think this was regarded by some people as rather odd that I should sit and think and not go out and whoop it up. But that's what I felt like. And I suppose this is perhaps connected to the thought that I had given in the hospital about the foolishness of war and the importance of preventing future wars.
You had seen enough of that, you know, at first hand, hadn't you?
Yes, that's right. But so had lots of people. And I suppose if I'd been in London, I might have gone to Trafalgar Square or Piccadilly Circus or something like that and behaved entirely differently. But I wasn't in either case in that situation, which perhaps helps to explain why I just sat and thought.
Yes, also, as you've explained, you had this very long period in the hospital.
Mm.
And I can imagine that, you know, you had plenty of time to think.
Yes,
over what could have happened.
That was right. Think and read. Read, for example, about the Treaty of Versailles, which I think was a complete disaster and led on to the Second World War. There's a direct connection between the Treaty of Versailles 1918-19 and Hitler, because the Treaty of Versailles was a treaty of revenge. It was Clemenceau who wanted revenge. The leading statesmen were Clemenceau, Wilson for the United States, and Lloyd George for Britain. And Clemenceau knew what he wanted, which was revenge for the Franco-Prussian War, for example. And Lloyd George, I think, had his mind on the forthcoming election. And Wilson was an idealist, a very fine person, was really, I think, the inventor of the League of Nations, but couldn't actually deliver. And of course, we all know that the great disaster about the League of Nations was that the American Congress wouldn't ratify the treaty. And so the United States withdrew into its shell, really, for the next 20-something years, leaving the French and the British to keep the peace in Europe. And the Treaty of Revenge against Germany had extracted from the Germans vast reparations, had stripped Germany of its colonies in Africa and Asia, and had said that, amongst other things, that Germany would have no troops in the Rhineland, that is, west of the River Rhine, between the Rhine and France. And the result of all those penalties for Germany was that there was colossal unemployment, colossal inflation. People took their money to the shops in wheelbarrows, we're told. And that led to Hitler, who was elected. He didn't come to power by a coup. He was elected in a straightforward election. And, of course, when he rearmed right away, began a program of rearmament, and then he took his troops into the Rhineland in breach of the treaty, and France and Britain did nothing, just sat there. And Hitler must have said to himself, well, this is wonderful. These people, the French and the British, are never going to oppose me at all. So that led to his annexation of Austria. That led, after that, to his taking of the Sudetenland around the borders of Czechoslovakia, eventually Czechoslovakia itself, and then his attack on Poland. And having had all those successes, he thought, I suppose, that we weren't going to resist him over Poland. But that by that time we had done a bit of rearmament, and therefore we did resist him. The problems of the British government, and I suppose of the French government, in the 1930s were very considerable. I've been criticizing them both for not resisting, and they deserve criticism.
Of course, pacifism was a very strong force.
Very powerful. There was something called the Fulham by-election, which took place in the mid-1930s, where a government majority, a conservative government majority, was overturned, a big majority was lost, because of the activities of the Peace Pledge Union, which was dedicated to disarmament and thought that it would help to keep the peace by being pacifist. And that, of course, just gave the green light to Hitler. I had a visit recently from a young man who wanted to interest me in a proposal for a Ministry of Peace, which had a certain amount of support, though I think not very much because I haven't heard any more about it. And I told him what I've just been saying, that is to say, I told him about the lessons of pacifism in this country and France in the 1930s, which had led to war. And I said, I don't think your Ministry of Peace will do anything except if it gathers momentum, weakening our resolve and increasing the likelihood of war, although a major war nowadays is very unlikely because of the collapse of the Soviet Union.
So it's interesting because, you know, your thoughts about war and peace, you know, and your interest in pursuing peace, it seems to be you weren't a pacifist, you weren't becoming a pacifist.
The opposite. I believe in the Roman maxim, si vis pacem, para bellum. If you want peace, prepare for war. Absolutely right. And that's what we have done. And that's why, one of the reasons we've kept the peace. We've had a treaty of cooperation with Germany. We realized, having learnt the lesson of 1918, the right thing to do was to bring the Germans into a cooperative relationship with the West. And that has worked wonderfully well for the last, it's now about 60 years, isn't it? And the Germans have learnt about democracy extraordinarily well. The great trouble about Germany has been that the Russians occupied the eastern half of Germany, and getting East Germany and West Germany together has proved extremely difficult. But the peace has been kept. I used to go to conferences at a place called Königswinter on the Rhine near Bonn. For some years I went there in the 70s and 80s. And that was a forum which met annually between the Germans and the British, politicians, journalists, academics, anybody interested in these matters. And we discussed matters of mutual interest between the two sides. And it started off soon after the war, when it was invented by Robert Burley, who had been, I think, active in the peacemaking in Germany right after the war, who became the headmaster of Eton, or was at some time the headmaster of Eton. And there was a woman from Dusseldorf, the wife of an industrialist there, who believed exactly in the things we believed in. And she really was the motive, provided the motive force on the German side. And these conferences were extremely useful because the journalists and the academics were able to spread the word about them. And the Germans were deeply interested in learning from us. In the early stages, that was what happened. We taught the Germans. Later on, the Germans taught us because they were caught on very quickly to the modern world and to democracy and the economic system that we were adopting. So that was another example of how the lessons of Versailles were won. Were adopted.
Yes, perhaps we'll come back later to that conference, you know, when we talk about the end of the Cold War and was there any discussion for reunification? But that's later on, really, isn't it?
Yes,
it's
unification.
You're saying of in this context, because your attitude to war and peace was very much based on politics, wasn't it? The right sort of political arrangements and this give and take and mutual understanding, cooperation, reconciliation.
All those things, but also economics. Because if the economics had gone wrong, as they did in the 1930s in Germany, there would have been trouble. The Germans would have said, these arrangements are no good. And so bringing Germany into the European common market, which happened in 1957, was a very important move. I'll come back to that if I talk about my later activities in the Foreign Office, because I was on the European Integration Desk. That was my first job in the Foreign Office.
Well, talking about your hatred of war and this sort of wastage, the young men, you know, the sort of things you experienced directly, you of course would have been in an area which was overrun and by World War One, wouldn't you? Or where the attrition, the war of attrition occurred.
Yes.
I wonder if you came across anything, you know, during your time in France and Belgium, which impressed you about war and the wastage and futility.
Well, we did, on our way through France and Belgium, we did, of course, go over the territory which had been fought over in 1914 to 1918. I remember we, in this very rapid movement from Normandy to Belgium, we had to stop, of course, from time to time, and one night we camped at Passchendaele, and I went for a bit of a walk that evening and found a German cemetery from the First World War and was struck by the gloom of that cemetery with its black tombstones, row on row of black tombstones, and what a contrast I felt with the Commonwealth cemeteries, which were very sad places, but nevertheless they were beautifully kept, the gardens were tended, the flowers were there, and of course the tombstones, one for each soldier, officer or other rank, were white and very carefully kept clean. And that's a very interesting contrast. The Germans don't seem to me to be so gloomy now. I don't know them very well, I'm sorry to say. But that was obviously the thing they thought was right, these black tombstones at the end of World War One.
That must have been very poignant. You know, that war had ended and here you were fighting another one.
Yes, and my father, from 1915 to 1918, had been in that area. And he was in the infantry, too, and survived without a scratch, which was quite amazing. But that made it a bit more poignant. Especially since, at the time I'm talking of, in the Second World War, he was a prisoner of war of the Japanese.
Yes, you did explain earlier how you met your father after the war.
Mm.
And again, it was very poignant. You should have hugged each other and your upbringing.
I regret that now. I mean, if it was happening now, I would have hugged him. I would have rushed into his arms. But in those days, we sort of circled one another and shook hands. Absolutely amazing. Very... what is regarded as characteristic Victorian British behaviour. But I suppose there's something in it, really. We were a very stiff upper lip. But that wasn't an occasion for the stiff upper lip.
I suppose the important thing was the feeling was there, although you didn't...
The feeling was intense, but we didn't know how to express it. We should have been absolutely natural and done what my instinct was, to rush into his arms. But he wasn't apparently rushing into my arms. He'd been in a Japanese prisoner of war camp for the last 4 years, only just got out of it, so I suppose that may have accounted for the fact that he in particular was very reserved. He must have had to suppress his emotions for 4 years.
So what were your plans, you know, having learnt to cope with your crutches and getting better? What did you hope to do post-war, having had these thoughts about war and peace?
I wanted to go to Oxford, and the Canadian Army, after the European War ended, had an arrangement, since it couldn't take all the troops back to Canada in short time because there weren't enough ships. They had an arrangement by which if a member of the Canadian Armed Forces could get himself or herself into a university in this country, then they would release that person and pay him or her full pay, free of tax, and pay the fees at the university. Well, that looked to me a very good bargain, but also it gave me what I wanted, which was to go to Oxford. So I went to Oxford in the autumn of 45, where I made some friends who have been with me ever since. 60 years now, amazing. And then, unfortunately, the Canadian Army decided to demobilize me in the spring of 46, which meant that the money which I'd been receiving ran out. And my father was very keen that I should go into the family law firm in Sussex. And so I left Oxford and went into the family law firm as a I forget what the word was, but it's really as a student.
Had you got a degree at all when you left? Did you have any qualifications?
I had a degree from the University of Toronto in classics, which I got in 2 years instead of three, because I bought the last year for $150, as I think I may have mentioned already. But that was an arrangement made by the Canadian universities with the approval of the Canadian government to encourage people to volunteer. And of course, as I may already have said, until late in 1942, every member of the Canadian forces during the Second World War was a volunteer. Amazing. Lots of them. And it was only in the late part of 42 that there was any conscription, and then only for service in Canada. And it was only in the early part of 1945 that any conscripted person was sent overseas. So, coming back to Oxford and whether I had a degree, I didn't get a degree at Oxford. I was told by the master of my college that if I worked very hard in the three terms I was going to be there, in PPE, politics, philosophy and economics, and I took one exam in each of them, I could get a degree if I passed all three exams. He was wrong about that because, as I subsequently discovered, having worked extremely hard to get these three things in three terms, you couldn't get a degree until you had had five terms residence. And of course, that was a bit too late, I discovered that. Anyway,
End of Reel 5, Lord Peter Blaker.